Have we thought about rebranding or relabeling Biden? Like Biden AI?
I'm not sure where you're going with this. You said we were going to have to scrap this before we started recording, but...
Oh, so you agree this is a great idea. As you've seen in the tech space, because... AI is the new what? Like, what was the, like, of the last 3 years, what was... Like, it was always like Uber for X or whatever, but not Uber X, but Uber for X.
Right.
Yeah, everything is AI now. Like, right. Literally, you just slap AI on it and you get way more investment, or people are way more excited about your product. So it's like MSG. You just sprinkle a little bit in and everybody's happier. So has the Biden reelection campaign considered that? That's my free suggestion to maybe sort of preserve democracy. I don't know.
I mean,
don't ask me. I'm just a red panda. Yeah. God, I miss it. He's on hiatus. Yeah, even on Blue Sky.
Mm.
We need him more than ever. But
isn't Threads getting close to doing the whole? It's not Metaverse. It's what is it called? Fediverse.
Cheese.
See, you know, even
when I'm half asleep and I'm on Zyrtec, I'm still crushing it.
All right. Is that what it's called? The Fediverse, the thing where all the socials connect to each other?
Like, somebody had a good thing, and this was on Threads, which is, like, X is Twitter for the alt-right now. Blue Sky is Twitter for hippies. Threads is Twitter for normies. And Mastodon is Twitter for, like, Linux admins. And it feels like that's fairly accurate. And this is, again, 100% not my take, but I don't remember the source for it. But no, the Fed of... I've tried to learn about it, and I don't really know what the Fediverse is. Like, I know vaguely what it is, and that the Facebook is holding true to their commitment that they were going to make Threads, like, back-populate into the... activity pub compliant stuff. This is not interesting, but apparently yes, they are.
Okay, got it.
But regardless, I don't think Darth will ever sign up for a Facebook owned social network, so unfortunately, yeah, things are still looking bleak. I can't ask, because you're gonna scrap it. I'm still very curious about the thing that you posted this weekend, and anyway.
Oh yeah, we should talk about that offline or something.
No, I'm still, you know, anyway. Anyway, I think it's a complicated story. All right,
to put a bow on this, according to,
wait, you have AI thoughts?
Not AI thoughts, Fediverse thoughts. According to Wikipedia, the Fediverse is an ensemble of social networks which can communicate with each other while remaining independent platforms. Users on different social networks and websites can send and receive updates from across the network.
It's got a really stupid name, though.
Fediverse.
Like, I get what federation means in that technology sense, but it sounds real dumb. And in the same way, like, I don't think anybody will ever... And anybody who that... Have you known anybody normal that uses Mastodon?
No.
Yeah, that's the thing. Even people who have accounts are like, even like Joanna Stern doesn't post to it. I think I have an account on something there, but I've never, even I don't want it, and I'll sign up for everything.
And another fun fact, the Fediverse is a, and here's your SAT word for the day, which I'm probably not. Wow, look at you. You're on the Wikipedia page too.
I'm not, but that's what that's when you stick to, when you smush two words together, it's a portmanteau. That's,
look at you. Wow.
You go tell me about cost basis, something or other. What give me a long big word,
man. My SAT scores really weren't that great, so
it's nothing to do with the SATs.
This all checks out. Wasn't that part of the SATs, like you had to know fancy words? Am I misremembering that?
I think you are. I think you're thinking of the GRE. I don't think, anyway. Yeah, Biden AI.
Biden AI, trademark.
Oh, I'm going to keep forgetting about this, but what can you tell me what stage of the
stage of grief that I'm in about the country?
No, it's fine. There's a Marin County thing that I mean to discuss, but I don't remember what it is. So that's probably for
everybody. Yeah, people like it when we get hyper local.
Mm-hmm. What portion of the NBA season are we in?
There are, I think, about a dozen or so games left in the regular season. So like two to 3 weeks left, I think.
Is my chip guy doing well?
Who?
My chip guy?
Your chip guy. Oh, yeah. Tatum.
No, Anthony Davis.
Oh, hey, well, Tatum's the other chip guy.
But Anthony Davis has the best Ruffles flavor. Actually, no, he doesn't. It's tied. Because Jason Tatum, I think I kind of flamed out. Or I think I overindulged and then it became problematic. Not in that kind of way. But the Flamin' Hot Barbecue ones became too much. But Anthony Davis has a very, very pleasant lime and jalapeno flavor of Ruffles. So he's my chip guy. NVIDIA and Anthony Davis.
so your chip guy and his team, the Los Angeles Lakers, they are of Anaheim, right? So they are in ninth place in the Western Conference. Which means that
that's
they would be, it's not great, no, which it means that they would be in, I guess what I would describe, the bottom half of the play-in tournament. We've talked about this on the show. So
they had the in-league tournament or something. What's the play-in tournament?
The in-season tournament. The play-in tournament is where seeds 7 through 10 in each conference play one another to determine who makes the playoffs. So the way it works is the 7 and 8 seeds play each other. The winner gets into the playoffs. The loser then has to play the winner of the 9-10 game. And the loser of the 9-10 game is out. And then obviously whoever loses that second game is also out. So as things stand now, the Lakers would play the Warriors.
I see that. And I think that's kind of a backhanded uncompliment to your team because the Warriors are not good this year.
And they have played one another in the play-in tournament. This was a few years ago now. What was different about that, though, was, if I remember correctly, they were the 7 and 8 seeds at that time. So even though the Warriors lost that game, they went on to play another game. Although I think they did end up then losing that. But anyway, it wasn't a single elimination situation when they last played each other in the play-in tournament. But if things stay the way they are now, then it would be. But yeah, okay, both teams are not very good, and I would say are very unlikely to do a whole lot, even if they do make the playoffs.
Got it. And the reason I bring that up, because since the Warriors aren't doing terribly well and I don't have cable, I don't watch a ton of basketball right now. And this is something that did not cross my desk, or I just saw in passing at a bar. Who is the court sponsor for the Warriors at Chase Center?
I have no idea. I don't think I've watched a single Warriors game this year. I've watched very, very little basketball in general.
Do you want to take a guess? You get three guesses, and that's because it's particularly relevant to this show or what we frequently care about.
So it's not Miller and Lux.
Okay, no joke guesses.
Who said that was a joke guess?
It's in the same building, and Ty Flo. We'll get to that someday. Ty Flo is not It doesn't have that kind of money.
Seems like he's doing pretty well.
He has certain kinds of money, but not that kind of money.
Yeah. I don't really have any legitimate guesses. I have no idea.
Okay. I'm going to send you a link.
Stuff in Slack. Okay, here we go. All right. No, this isn't real.
Swear to God. I was like, it has been this way for a while. It shows how much I've been paying attention to the Warriors recently. But it's been for like a season and a half, or like this entire season, I think like half of last season. One Password, also not from the Bay Area. I think, aren't they based in Toronto?
Somewhere in Canada, yeah.
Yeah, they are the Court, and also hold on, Warriors jersey.
I don't know if you know this level of detail, but is their logo actually painted onto the court, or is this one of those?
It's not digitally imposed. I don't know how permanent. I don't think it's as permanent as Chase, but it's on the court.
It could just be maybe the fact that this photo that you sent me is a bit low resolution, but it looks like it's a digital graphic, but.
Yeah, I took it. Yeah, it does kind of look like the thing where they use the thing to make it look like the 10-yard line is on the field. That is correct.
Right.
Or actually, I hate this. I don't know if they still do this, but this was a thing maybe 3 years ago where they would try to use like superimposed graphics to show like the trail of somebody like moving around the basketball court to like show their range or whatever. Have they eased out of that?
Again, not watched a whole lot of basketball this season, but yeah, I don't feel like I see a lot of that.
No.
Official Password manager of the Golden State Warriors.
Hey, Bay Area, we could be more pumped to announce that 1Password is teaming up with the Golden State Warriors. We know that passwords and basketball might seem like an odd match at first, but you may have heard that defense wins championships, and defense is 1Password's specialty. After all, talk about an MVP. That's a good copy.
It's not bad. It's not bad. Give Emily, who appears to be the writer of this article, give her a raise. That's pretty good.
I was gonna say, I don't want to sound weird. It seems she never mind. I was gonna say that she looks too warmly dressed for California. Anyway, secure your home court, protect your loved ones with 1Password, and get 25% off your first year.
Tough break for LastPass.
Tough break for LastPass. It hasn't LastPass. Aren't they like the T-Mobile of password managers? They have a different data breach. Like every LastPass is bad, right?
I've been using 1Password for I don't even know how many years now, and don't pay any attention at all to anybody other than 1Password. So I don't know.
If you Google LastPass breach, there's 1.49 million results. Every password manager that's not 1Password sucks. Like there's also something called Dashlane that I think I sort of looked at once. They're all really janky. Yeah. Anyway, that's a interesting sponsorship, and it makes more sense than a lot of them. And that was pretty cool. All right. We got some follow-up or some leftover business, maybe?
We do. I need to hear more about the one I'm pretty sure is a happy conclusion to your pretty awful-sounding Synology situation.
Did we talk about that on the show?
The Synology thing we did, yeah. And you left listeners with the cliffhanger that you had purchased a new Synology and were going to attempt a data transfer by just like putting the drives from the old one into the new one.
So it has a happy both a happy and a sad ending. The sad ending is the fact that this nonsense cost me $1,100. which we'll actually discuss. You'll help me with the amortization schedules, but the positive news
depreciation is really what you're looking for there, but continue.
Double declining. Yeah. It worked in the sense that, and actually somebody on Reddit was saying that they've made some enhancements to the Disk Station Manager software where you actually don't, even if you move the drives, you actually, it's not critical to keep them in the same like order anymore, which is kind of, that's a nice thing.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, I feel like that's maybe a place where somebody could mess it up.
Did you, so you did keep them in the same order?
Yeah. Like,
yeah. That's smart. Yeah.
Yeah. So now I just moved all the drives, and then I think I sent you a screenshot, which, I am too tired to go look up, but I think it had a little thing. I said, hey, like, do you want to move your, it,
yeah, they, I mean, they even had like
you mentioned that it was worded optimistically.
Well, yeah, they definitely. I should scroll up and try to find this. It's kind of impressive that I mean, they had like a, you know, full on like interface for the basically this exact scenario. So yeah, I found it,
so
here.
It says welcome back.
Welcome back with an exclamation mark, of course. Very very Microsoft.
Very Walgreens. No,
very
nice.
Very 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 Windows. Or nice. so yeah, and they even like, I'm looking at the fine print in this graphic, like they even, you know, knew which model Synology these drives were coming from.
They knew which busted ass piece of hardware they sold me that apparently just, cause I posted to the Synology subreddit asking a couple of things about this, and I got a couple of not nice or helpful responses that says, this is one of the most frequently asked questions on here. Learn to use the search function.
That happens on Reddit.
Didn't need the dickishness, but also apparently once I did use the search function, this happens a lot, and the DS1815 after 4 to 6 years will just die. That's great. Apparently the DS1821, at least fingers crossed so far, does not have some weird bug where the Intel CPU will just give up.
See, the other thing about this graphic and the optimism around it that strikes me as maybe being a little tone deaf is I would imagine that it's not all that often when people are changing out their Synology just for fun. Like, I want to upgrade my Synology. Like, I would imagine 97% of the time, it's your scenario, which is the old one died, and you've been now forced to buy a new one.
Or I guess that makes sense in the sense that this screen only pops up when you shove the drives into a new one, which if you were like upgrading from like a 4-bay to an 8-bay,
I mean,
that maybe
sure,
would not be the case.
But I would imagine that would not be that common. I don't know. Maybe yeah. It's more common than I'm giving you credit for. But I guess my main question for you is, on this UI, there's just a single button that just says migrate. So was it literally just a matter of pressing that and it just worked?
I think I had to like select a password and stuff.
Yeah. That was it.
The one thing, and I got to research this more because this... So wait, does this mean that the password on my Synology doesn't do anything? Because like I just took the drives out of the old one and it... had passwords, and I assumed maybe some kind of encryption.
I don't,
honestly haven't looked into it.
I don't think, yeah, like I don't, I, so I have a,
because it never asked me for my old password. So,
well, I'm
is that,
sure,
is that the workaround?
Well, I'm sure there is an option to have the data on your Synology encrypted. I've come to think of it, I'm almost positive mine's not. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't keep anything like in the same way that I was talking about the last time we spoke, which is that had this failed entirely, like I don't have anything on there that is 100% irreplaceable. Like I don't do a single backup to anything. Like there, it is.
Well, I mean, of course, if you did, I'd be ashamed of you. You know.
Well,
better. you know.
Well,
than
you.
That.
Well, but you've also given me so much shit for not having my photos backed up in the cloud for like 4 months.
Yeah, well, that's
it's resolved now, but
yeah.
Anyway, like it's fine, and when we think about it, excuse me, allergies. I bought this. I sent you a screenshot, so I bought it in 2016. So what's 2024 minus 2016? 7.5, 8 years. What's 7.5 times 12? 90. So I paid $1,000 because this was back when B&H didn't charge tax to California. So I paid on average $12.82 a month. So like, even though this was an unexpected, irritating expense, I can't be that mad for how much life I got. Like I'd be much more pissed off if I lost data or this was a much more, fresh, like difficult thing, but had a good run.
Yeah, I mean, so, I feel you.
I wish it had failed in a less sudden way. Then I would be way less irritated if there was some hint that this was going to happen, and it didn't induce the panic attack.
Yeah, I would be bummed if mine failed and would be annoyed at the expense, in part because as far as technology purchases go, a network-attached storage device is not the most exciting one.
It's very appliancey.
Very appliancey. Like, with my Synology, I very rarely even see it because it's just like in a closet. I very rarely interact with it in any sort of way. It just kind of runs in the background. So, you know, usually technology purchases, particularly of that cost, are more exciting.
Yeah.
But anyway, an important piece of tech.
Yep. So yeah.
Well, I'm glad that went well. I was a little skeptical, but I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah. All right, and then I don't remember this. I think you can just put a link in the show notes, and the Wall Street Journal thinks I'm a robot. It's fine. Oh yeah, there was a good video, and you'll just put a link in there. But Joanna Stern had a thing. She 6 months or a year ago did a whole thing about, she's comparing like the top three or four contenders for her family to get an EV, and she ultimately decided on the Ford Mach-E. And when Tesla lit up a portion of the supercharger network to work with the little Ford NACS adapter thingy, she did a good video that highlighted a ton of stuff. If I'm remembering correctly, there was a great visualization using a drone of kind of why the cord length and parking space back-end situation is going to be irritating or kind of lead to parking lot fistfights and stuff. But like it was very JoJo. It's always really informative, a little funny, and like 5 to 10 minutes. So strongly recommend. And I don't think the videos on her column are paywalled. So yeah.
Yeah, we won't belabor this point too much because I think we did talk about it before when talking about non-Tesla EVs using superchargers, but it is so crazy that because of the charging port location on non-Tesla vehicles, it's often the case that the cable at a supercharger stall, which is not very long, won't reach the vehicle. And in situations where you run into that, Tesla's actual recommendation on their website is to do what Joanna Stern highlights, which is you sometimes have to like park in the spot next to the one that you're supposed to be in for the stall that you're using, which then means that you're blocking the stall for the spot that you're in. So you're basically taking up two supercharger stalls to charge your one vehicle, which is just very, very Tesla, but also very, very bad. I can't remember if I put this in the thing, before, but I'll put it in the notes and I'll send it to you now. Tesla has confirmed that they are working on an extension cable, which like, I mean, is kind of helpful, but then also like how many people are actually going to buy this? Cause it's probably going to be really expensive.
Well, a couple things here. Before we go into that, did you ever uncover if there's any rhyme or reason as to which superchargers are, because it's not the entire network. Was there any like logic or in deciding which ones are?
I haven't read enough into it to know the answer to that for sure. I don't think so. I mean, I think at a minimum, a supercharger station would have to be like a version 3 station in order to work with a non-Tesla vehicle. But I think most of them are now.
Well, so that's the reason I was going to ask, because I'm not super plugged into the supercharger news and that kind of stuff. But aren't they on like Gen 4 now? And the ones that are like the newest ones, have longer cables.
Correct. So the version 4, which you're right, is the one that they're on now, the cable length on those stalls, I think, basically can reach wherever the charge port is on your car. So if you're at a V4 station, this is all basically a non-issue. But I think that the percentage of stations that are V4 is very, very small. And Tesla in the past hasn't been super fast to upgrade stations. So so anyway, that seems like a little bit of a mess, which is kind of a shame, because I think the rest of the experience seems like it works pretty well. Yeah, it'll be interesting over the next 2 to 3 years to see kind of how all of that plays out, because, I mean, especially here in California, supercharger capacity, particularly if you're on, you know, a popular route, say like on I-5 or something, and you're driving, you know, at the 5, sorry.
Thank you. Jeez.
I know. I've been in the Bay Area for, you know, going on 15 years now.
It's no excuse.
You know, supercharger stations can get pretty full. So, you know, the combination of non-Tesla vehicles being able to use the stalls and some of them having to take up 2 spots in order to charge just feels like it's, I don't know. See, it feels like something to monitor over the next couple of years.
Let's actually let's move some things around. Let's talk about the other car stuff real quick. What was Ford EV? Oh yeah.
Ugh.
So such a bummer. Hush. Oh, that I mean, well, anyway, we're gonna have to be very different on that. Did you? It's been a couple weeks. Rivian, which now I think is just broadly accepted as what I think everybody hopes is going to be the number 2, and the, like, they're now like the sane EV company. Is that the prevailing sentiment?
They're going to be kind of the, what Threads is to Twitter.
EVs for non-alt-right
Norms. Exactly. Yeah. Yep. It's not even, that analogy is not even much of a stretch, because it's literally the same person involved in both analogies. So
exactly.
There you go.
So they had this event, and also, is Rivian based in Orange County?
Irvine, yeah.
Okay, them and Vizio, or the Princess TV, or whatever the thing was from 4 weeks ago. So the current stable of Rivian cars is the R1T, which is the truck, and the R1S, which is 2.5 years old at this point, maybe. And those start out at like 80 grand, right?
R1T. the truck starts at 70, and then the R1S starts at 76.
Okay, so pricey cars,
but very pricey. Yeah,
like not quite Model S, Model X territory, but up there.
The R1S is definitely a better value.
Oh,
than,
totally.
than the Model X.
But the Model X, I think, sure, starts at, like, when it came out, and probably still now, like, is like 90 to 100, right?
It's come down, but I'm kind of trying to quickly look this up now. Order now starts. When does this start at? Get rid of all like the probable savings and all that. So the Model X starts at 80. So a little more expensive, but the R1S is bigger, I believe. Like it's got like a legitimate third row, similar to like a, you know, like a Tahoe or something. Whereas the Model X,
I thought you said there were no cars for you.
Well, I mean, believe me, the R1S is absolutely the car that I would purchase, but I mean, $76,000 is,
well, how much would a Ford Expedition EV be?
Well, that was cheaper. So then, not to merge two different stories together, but like that was Ford's thing when they announced that 3-row EV SUV is, you know, not only was it going to be a bigger SUV, but it was going to be built on their new EV platform, which was meant to be more affordable. So they didn't announce hard pricing, but they did imply that it would be less expensive than, you know, what's currently available. But I guess to rip off the Band-Aid here, you know, Ford's going through a bit of a pivot, if you will, with their EV strategy, and evidently that car has been put on hold. So yeah, my car strategy now is to hope that the R1S comes down in price or that I somehow get rich.
Or just buy an EV9. It's ugly, God. But it does what you want.
I haven't seen an EV. So I saw an EV9 at the local Kia dealership. I drove by it very quickly, so I didn't get a very good look. In the neighborhood, though, we've got a couple of EV6s, which, oh boy, not any better looking in person, I can confirm. And actually, I should have taken a picture of this to send to you. There is a person on, I think, like the street behind us, who has a Chevy Blazer EV, like brand new. Must be
because
one
that's on a Barbie movie. Product placement works.
That car also not any better looking in person. Better looking than the EV6 for sure, but that's a pretty low bar.
So two things, just because I'm going to forget about this for the next show opener, but also one, I promise we are to people listening that we will get to the Apple Department of Justice stuff soon. But the other bit is you brought this up because we have, I mean, I think people will know about this already, but we have the in our internal super secret Slack, a channel only for obnoxious electric vehicle vanity plates. And you brought up that you saw a Cybertruck in your neighborhood. And But so I just want to say, I want to go on the record here because this was going to be a show opener at some point in time, but whatever. The cruelest thing that you can do. Oh, don't make me.
No, this is something different. Okay. I just say.
So nobody who's buying a Cybertruck is a well person. And the cruelest thing that you can do, and by which I mean the most honest and righteous thing you can do, is never take a picture of it or acknowledge their purchase. Because nobody buys that car because they want a car that they think is the right car for them. They want to be looked at and gawked at. So the cruelest thing you can do is not take a picture and not acknowledge them. Just because they bought like some bootleg Temu version of an OXO cheese grater that's on four wheels. Don't take a picture of it. It's fine.
You know the other, not that this is even the craziest part about the Cybertruck, but do you know that the version of it they're shipping now, I think, is called the Founders Edition, I want to say. Do you know how much it is?
90.
120,000. That's the only one. If you want to take delivery today, that's the only one you can buy. It's insane.
Good.
I mean, not that any prices, you know, would make that car something I would want to buy.
Every dipshit buying one wastes as much money as possible. And I hope they part their entire retirement savings in Dogecoin. And no, it's
oh,
no.
Man.
Anyway. So yeah, don't take a picture of it. And also, I'm sorry that your property values are probably going to go down soon with that. Because I assume it's somebody who lives in the area.
I don't know. I mean, I've seen a couple of them on the freeway. So this is not the first one I've seen, but it was on the freeway and it wasn't really any particularly close to my house. This one was on just a residential street in my little, you know, sleepy Marin neighborhood. And I saw it driving my daughter to preschool, which I thought, oh man.
And then you told her. That's a bad person.
Yeah. Good stuff.
Anyway,
so getting back to the
thank you R2.
Did we even talk about this? So Rivian announced the R2.
Yes, yeah, so that's what people were expecting is, hey, it's been a couple of years. Where is going to be the Model 3, Model Y equivalents of Rivian going not down market, but a more mass market car, and that was going to be the R2S. Or is it R2?
It's just R2.
Okay, so there's not going to be a truck of this, or at least not for now.
No,
okay.
No. So the R2 is visually very, very, very similar to the R1S, basically just a bit smaller.
Does it have a third row option?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Because if so, you kind of have to buy it with the name.
With the what?
The name isn't R2 a Star Wars thing?
No, R2-D2. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Good call.
R2 third row.
I
don't think so.
I don't think so. No. Although, so I sent you a graphic in the thing, which will be in the Verge article, which we put in the notes. I've been meaning to actually look up like
metric?
I know that is kind of weird. The size difference between the R1S and the R2, and Rivian has a very nice graphic, but for whatever reason is in millimeters. But you can even actually put aside the numbers and just kind of visually look at this picture, and it shows you that it's smaller for sure, but dramatically so.
Well, I've got a small car, and this is 2 inches shorter than that car. Huh. The R2 is smaller than I thought it was going to be. And the R3 is like, we'll get to a cute little guy. But.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's
185 inches long.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a small smallish crossover. That's 187. That's cool. Cause the R what's 50. Okay. 5,100 millimeters in inches. Yeah. Okay. Well, cause yeah, the R2 is so yeah. So wait, what's 70? So it's a foot and a half shorter. That makes sense because the R1S is a big old car.
The R1S is in the, you know, not quite like Chevy Tahoe, like full size, you know, gas SUV, but close because it's got a third row and it's got, you know, like a legitimate like trunk behind that third row. So it's a pretty good size car. But you know the R2, it's a few interesting things about it. So, it allegedly is going to start at 45,000. Although, you know, there's now a long history of EV manufacturers announcing pricing on their forthcoming EV that's a couple of years out, and then only to have final pricing be significantly different. So, you know, we'll see. Another interesting thing about the R2, which I predicted on the show, although you apparently don't remember me saying this, so you have to go back and listen to the tape. But as far as I know, it is the first car officially announced with a NACS port built right in. So, you know, unlike what Ford's doing, and actually Rivian's also now supercharger compatible, but because all of those cars have CCS charge ports, you have to have an adapter to then, you know, plug into a supercharger, but the R2 is going to have an NACS port built right in. It is in the back of the vehicle, which is nice, which is different than the current Rivians where the charge port's in the front, and that's the way that a lot of non-Tesla EVs are. However, it's on the passenger side, not the driver's side, like with Tesla. And I looked into that a little bit more, and that's because this keeps the R2 more easily compatible with Rivian's charging network because the charge port is on the same side as the current version of the R1T and R1S. But
do they have a charge network?
As a small one, yeah. The Adventure Network, I believe, is what it's called. So, you know, good that it has an NACS port built in, but because of its location, it's gonna end up having the issue where if you're at, you know, a non V4 supercharger, the cable's not gonna reach it. So that's not great, but step in the right direction at least.
Yeah, I mean, but going back to the car overall, like it looks cool.
It looks really nice.
It looks like they. Is it not decanted? That's what you do to wine. But there's a term for when you kind of try to make something cheaper and you kind of try to pick and choose and be wise about where you take stuff out. But like, it seems like the stuff that they took out was a lot of the maybe like superfluous or kind of like, yeah, it looks like a lot of good compromises, and it retains the happy face that I know you hate, but I think is fun.
You're
warming up to it.
I'm warming up to it. Yeah, I would actually say, in general, like even with like the R1S, like I wouldn't say like the first time I saw one, I like was instantly like in love with it. But over time, I've gotten more into it. And then the rest of the car, like the headlights aside, is really nice. Then the interior is really nice. It's just a good looking car for the most part.
Yeah, no CarPlay though.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's how you use your Monopoly power.
Oh.
So R2 looks neat, but then during that same announcement, and this was like a week and a half ago, they also shocked or surprised people that there was a the introduction. And also, sorry, let's say for the R2, not going to go into production until early 2026.
Yeah, it's a ways off. Up
on sale middle of the year.
Right.
So very, not vaporware, but like very, very pre-announce-y.
Yeah.
So, but then, yeah, they also announced the R3, which is cute little dude. I like it's a very, like, Americans don't really like, Americans want to, they're buying decisions, and that data does not suggest that they like hatchbacks or smallish cars. People think they do, but they don't actually buy them. But this is what the sizing on this one? Rivian R3 dimensions. Because this one, when you look at it on paper, is very small.
Yeah, no, this one is more
161 inches in length. So what is
this one's like a tall sedan, basically.
Toyota RAV4 length. Gee, this is the thing I hate about Toyota. Toyota keeps all their cars getting bigger and bigger every generation. The RAV4, which used to be the world's the tiny, tiny SUV, is now 181 inches. I'm trying to think of what's a good proxy for how big this thing will be. Yeah, I don't know. Actually, hold on. Mini Cooper Countryman length. 170. Okay. It's going to be a small car. And like it maintains, like what I really like about it is just that they've maintained and adapted the design language across the entire lineup, but it all still looks unique and each model has character. And I think that's really nice.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like this would be an amazing little city car.
For sure.
Yeah. So, yeah. Maybe that'll be my first EV.
And then they also announced the R3X, which is basically the
higher performance
version of the R3. Yeah, which of course is the one that you would buy because you're all about the performance when it comes to your cars.
No, I'm old now. I don't like fun. I don't like, the only thing that would maybe get me is that the way you know it's the performance edition is that it's got orange on it.
Mm,
so right. Therefore, that's what might get me.
There, but yeah,
are they doing the whole reservation thing? Did you put down $100 or $1,000 or something?
$100, I did. Yes, they're it's exactly what Tesla does, where it's a deposit in air quotes because it's totally refundable. It's basically just getting on the wait list, and the $100 is a way to have you put a little bit of skin in the game, and then also for Rivian to presumably earn a nice bit of interest on that cash for the next 2 years.
Did you check the box that says I'm purchasing for a company fleet, and then you just put technically correct as a business?
I did pretty quickly put down the $100. So we'll check back in this time in 2026.
Okay, let's blaze through two auto things, and then we'll get to I think we'll probably only broadly talk about the main topic, but
yeah.
Kashmir Hill, who is a really good journalist at the New York Times, she does a lot of reporting around the intersection of like the real world implications of tech, and a lot of it centers around privacy. Like she's written about like how smart home devices are not entirely well thought out and can be used for stalking and things like that. Her stories are very good. So if you click on the link to the article that's going to be linked below, you can see the stuff she's written previously. But most recently, a week and a half ago, she wrote about General Motors and also other manufacturers, but the most vivid examples in her story were from GM, because they have their OnStar telematics brand. You can't really say they're covertly sharing the information, because it is in some terms and conditions nonsense, but they are sharing drivers' driving habits with insurers through a couple of data brokers, LexisNexis and somebody else. And this is one of the things that as cars become computers on wheels, and as more and more and more and more stuff starts connecting to the internet, you have to think of what is the monetization strategy. There was a similar story about that we probably won't ever get to about Roku doing a terms and conditions update where you literally can't use your device anymore unless you hit the big accept button that says that you won't ever be able to sue the company. You can only do a binding arbitration. But as more stuff connects to the internet, it's not just that you are like signing a transactional relationship with the company to do a thing. They also have like backdoor deals to monetize the data that anything that connects to the internet generates. And in this case, cars produce a lot of data. And also that's information that insurers and people who might want to know more about the people driving the cars would want. So apparently through, what is it called? Safe driver, smart driver?
Something like that. Smart driver.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was a component of the OnStar service, which used to be back in the 90s, a thing where they put a cell modem in your car. Basically, it just gave you like a dedicated 911 button in the car. That now has like some thing where it'll tell you how safely you're driving, or like you get like it tries to gamify safe driving, but basically that also means every time you brake abruptly or speed when it thinks you're speeding, it will semi-anonymously, except it's not because it's still attached to the VIN of the car, go send all that data to data brokers that your insurer can then use to jack up your rates or deny you coverage. It's quite a story. And cut to the end. A week and a half later, they got sued there was a class action lawsuit started by somebody who got their insurance rates jacked up a whole bunch. And GM put out a statement saying they are suspending the smart driver. They're stopping the nonsense because they got caught, and they'll find, and it's suspended until they find a better way to not let it get out, I guess. It's an interesting story, and there was also a corresponding episode of The Daily that goes along with it. So if you're a more audio person, that is available in the New York Times audio app.
Yeah, the episode of The Daily was great. This article is great. Article will be in the notes. Obviously, this is all bad. I think you covered it pretty well. as maybe a little bit more of a lighthearted comment, which again is not condoning what GM did, but one of the screenshots in this article is apparently from like an actual driver who was unknowingly opted into this smart driver thing. And the screenshot that was provided basically covers this person's last week of driving, which is like 210 miles of distance covered. And one of the statistics that's shown is the percentage of those miles where your speed was over 80 miles an hour. And this person's percentage is like almost 20%, which, driving over 80 miles. I mean, I don't know. Maybe
I usually don't think that's, well, much of that was highway?
I guess maybe I'm being too California centric. We're here. There's not all that much road where like the speed limit is 75, where driving 80 would be reasonable. But I suppose in other parts of the country, a 75 mile an hour speed limit is more common. And so you're right. Maybe I'm unfairly knocking this person, but that did stand out to me. But yeah, maybe I'm being more too California specific. Also, I live in an area where the freeway up until you get pretty close to my house, is like a 55 mile an hour speed limit. So,
well, yeah, and you got to know where the speed traps are.
Yep.
it's a weird, interesting technology, because like there's a Bay Area company that pioneered this called Metromile, and then Progressive adapted it. Like, and if it's opt in,
that's fine.
But this was decidedly not.
Like, well, technically opt-in, but, like, wasn't the story that they covered on The Daily where, like, dealerships were basically turning this on at the point of delivery?
Well, but if you're opting into this smart driver thing, there's – sure, you're opting in, but somewhere deep – no, I don't think anybody is checking a box that says, hey, we're sending this directly to your insurer and anybody who's willing to pay for this data. So you're opting in, but let's say the car's not snitching on you with you doing absolutely nothing, but – the number of people who understood that that is what was happening for these little safety summaries is probably zero. And then why are you sad about Ford something?
Did we fully cover it? Yeah, I covered it earlier. They basically have scrapped the plans.
What was it supposed to be called?
They hadn't gotten to like a name or anything about it. So they're pivoting towards smaller, more affordable EVs. There was a kind of an interesting story that Electric ran today, though, where apparently one of their vehicles might possibly be like an escape-sized car. But, you know, because of the way you can kind of rejigger things with an EV and because of the fewer parts involved, it would end up actually having like the same interior space as like an Explorer. So it sounds similar to like an R2-ish kind of car. So I'm potentially interested in seeing what that is. But similar to the R2, it sounds like that's, you know, at least a couple of years away. So.
All right.
So I do already have an EV, so I have a bit of a leg up on you in that regard, but I think we're both in the same boat where, like, in my case, like, my current car doesn't really fit most of my needs anymore. But there's just not really like a logical other EV choice I could move to. All right, main topic.
Yeah, so this, I actually think we'll probably only discuss this at a high level in the interest of time, because also I think it needs more time to marinate, because I spent part of my weekend reading all 89 pages of this nonsense. But the Department of U.S. Department of Justice and 19 state attorneys general, I think, have they sued or just lodged a complaint? I don't know what the terminology is. But they are taking on Apple Incorporated, based out of Cupertino, California, for a variety of monopolistic and anti-competitive practices, which is great, right?
Is it?
I think so. Let's answer that at a very broad question. Do you think Apple, in its current form, needs to be subject to greater regulation and scrutiny?
I think, like, specifically what I think about with that is more around the App Store, which I have not read the full complaint, but I've obviously have read others' work who have, and it sounds like the App Store is not really discussed much, or maybe like at all, in the complaint. Is that right?
It is not, or they talk around it. Whenever they level an actual charge against the company and state that here is what we believe is behavior that disadvantages consumers or competitors or hurts competition in general that might have the end run result of benefiting consumers, they will talk about that briefly. But that is not the crux of the argument or the stuff they're actually going after.
Yeah, like that's when I think of practices of Apple's that, as a non-lawyer, feel a little monopolistic to me. I think more about the App Store, which obviously is sort of like what's been going on with the whole like DMA thing in the EU. and I think less about most of what the DOJ has brought up.
But to be more, to go back to the central question, I guess including, but maybe not primarily with respect to the App Store, do you think Apple deserves more regulation and or scrutiny?
I guess, yeah, like at a very high level, I guess I'd say yes to that.
Okay. And excluding the App Store, in what ways do you think Apple is maybe monopolistic or anti-competitive?
This isn't directly related to the App Store. I suppose it's tangentially related, but with things like music streaming, that's like the most obvious one that comes to mind. Like services where Apple themselves offers a service, but then other companies offer a competing service, you know, being the platform owner and being able to advantage themselves through that is complicated.
So I've been a Spotify fan for a long time, and I feel like anytime I've mentioned that, you always, maybe I'm conflating with you and Mike Hurley, but you've always been like, boohoo, if you can't afford 30% margins.
Well, I mean, Spotify's business is bad, but I mean, that's like a whole other,
but so is Apple's music's.
Well, of course, I mean, business, streaming,
but,
yeah,
but
streaming,
they also,
well, I mean, yeah, you could say it more, streaming music is a bad business. Yeah.
But it's
I mean,
an important business.
An important business, but a bad one. But I mean, that's
but it's worse when some fruit company says, give us 30% money.
Sure. But Apple,
for all the value that we gave you, yeah.
Apple's not the reason that Spotify's business is bad. I mean, it's a contributing factor, I suppose, but even absent the 30%, Spotify's business is still bad and they'd be still losing gargantuan amounts of money like they do. Which has much more to do with music royalties and all that, which is a, you know, that's a whole different thing.
So I would answer that question is that Apple deserves a ton of scrutiny, and that they're, here's the tricky part with this. So did you read any of it? It's okay if you did.
I did not. No.
So again, how do I summarize this in a couple sentences? The Justice Department, the complaint is weird where it tries to build a lot of narrative around it. And I think it's a lot of narrative that's meant to be addressed at a non-technical audience. But the entire thing is really frustrating to read because there are, I would say, like factual inaccuracies, but just a lot of like really silly and not well thought out, if you know anything about the situation, things that they use to support their point. But in general, the complaint talks about why Apple has been successful. And they pat themselves on the back several times, stating that their litigation against Microsoft in the late 1990s is one of the reasons why Apple was able to succeed. They malign the company, Apple, as being, what was the thing? So the quote, the Apple Computer Company, as it was called back then, was founded in 1976. Blah, blah, blah. From its inception, Apple had a knack for expensive, high-end design and niche marketing relative to its competitors, but it struggled against rivals that offered lower prices and more programs. After two decades, Apple struggled to compete against Windows and personal computers into the late 1990s and was on the brink of bankruptcy. So one, like they're just so frequently not explaining what makes Apple successful. And they think, like, I feel like the entire complaint suggests that people are only buying iPhones and Apple products because of marketing and because they don't think they have any other choices. And that's the thing that's frustrating about this, because even though you're kind of narrowing it down to the App Store as being the prime example of that lousiness that feels kind of endemic in Apple, the complaint, if you try to see the forest through the trees, I think can be summed up as saying they're taking on Apple advantaging itself due to the closed ecosystem environment that the iPhone is at the center of. And that manifests itself in two ways, which is And they explain it really well. What is the term? Quote, in the end, Apple deploys privacy and security justifications as an elastic shield that can stretch or contract to serve Apple's financial and business interests. So one of the hallmark things about Apple has marketed and staked their name on with respect to the products that they offer over the past decade has been privacy and security to advantage the user. But as to people who follow the company closely and know what they actually do, they will use that justification in anti-competitive ways that allow them to have justification for building features in a way that only they can and other people can't. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So it's them shifting the goalposts and choosing what that means and doing stuff that is allegedly in the user's favor to thwart competition is actually a really astute central thesis of the complaint. But then the other part is more of, and this is something that I actually hadn't thought about deeply, but that it's Apple's how they choose to keep certain technologies to themselves and how making it so that competing products can't be as good as their own on a tactical level is what keeps people locked in and prevents them from having to try harder to compete. Does that make sense?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, again, this is like, this is a very separate concept from like the law, but like, this is just more of like a, I guess, a personal anecdote. Like I stay with Apple because I'm happy what Apple does. And I'm not really sure that if there was more competition or whatever you want to call it, that would in any way persuade me to want to go out and buy an Android phone or start like using a Windows PC.
But you don't know what else could be.
Well, I mean, sure, but I sort of can't envision what that alternative would be. I mean, it's not impossible, but
I would pivot it or kind of change gears a little bit on how you're thinking of it, which is the opposite. So you're saying how easy it would be to switch to Android. One of the key things that they bring up is smartwatches and Apple Watches, where you had a Pebble, right?
I did, yeah.
Which, did you use that with an iPhone? Or which, what?
Yeah.
And it worked pretty jankily, right?
Yeah, it was not great.
Yeah. So there is no, even though like, I've had a Pixel Watch, I've had a Samsung Galaxy wearable, I've had a Fitbit that relayed notifications, I get to try a lot of stuff. There are no, if you are an iPhone user, there's no wearable product that can do what the Apple Watch can do, and it's not because the Apple Watch is better, it's because it's literally impossible. There's no way for you to, let's pretend that Some Mark Benioff wanted to make Pebble 2.0, and he just said, "Hey, here's $500 million. Go nuts, make the best smartwatch you can." They can't make anything that is nearly as good as the Apple Watch because it has no hooks into the system that allows them to do anything. They would have to run an app on the phone that would get forced out of memory all the time, that doesn't have rich integration into the system. So you don't know that there could be something better than the Apple Watch because nobody has ever had the opportunity to compete. Like, I feel like the other part of this is going back to the key stuff that they talked about in the argument, they think they don't talk about the App Store, but they do bring up like Xbox Game Pass and cloud gaming, which I actually like, that seems like the least interesting argument to me because they're saying that the only reason Apple doesn't want to let you use those things is because it makes you buy a more expensive phone because you need the nicer hardware. I don't think that's why. I think they're pissed that they can't get their 30% off of it. So I think that's kind of like a weird conclusion to draw. They don't like the messaging apps, but not for the right reason. They think it's more that because you can't like replace your default texting app or that legacy text messaging like SMS can't go into WhatsApp or whatever. That is kind of a tenuous conclusion to draw as well. But like, so there's that. And then it's more about those private APIs and withholding many, many technologies unto itself, which smartwatches are the most obvious example of. Then they also talk about digital wallets. So they talk about Apple Pay and Apple Wallet as being something that Apple created and will not open up to others under the guise of privacy. This one, I do think is an accurate, is a valid thing to try to investigate. But this is one, and actually kind of, I tried to avoid I held off on listening to the Six Colors podcast because I didn't want my like opinions to be tainted, but I did listen to half of it earlier today. And this is one where I actually am happy that Apple kind of didn't open things up, because if you had let financial institutions try to do what Apple Wallet did and any of them succeeded, there's no reality where it would have not been way shittier than Apple Wallet. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Like, that's the part where I, while yes, it is technically anti-competitive and not, and to the letter of the law, like probably is suspect. They brought this up on the Six Colors podcast. There's no way that your Clipper card and your Bank of America Visa and your Chase and everything would live side by side in a relatively, like, there's no prioritization or weird stuff except for Apple advantaging its own services, which goes back to the other thing, like, because Apple Cash, a thing I never want to use, is always somehow in there even though I keep turning it off. Like, there's all that crap, but that's not what they're complaining about. But like, that is one thing where Apple trying to create a unified system and do that stuff, which is probably gatekeeping-y, but actually worked out better for consumers. But that's the kind of stuff where them holding back the NFC chip and things like that does lend credence to that whole thing where privacy and security, only to the point where it makes Apple money or is a benefit that they can give to customers that's free to them. And that's the thing where, like, not competing fairly on music streaming, all those other things where Apple is not competing in a fair marketplace because they own the platform and created marketplaces that other people have to reside within. So while the complaint is messy and flawed in many ways, it is appropriately bigger than an app store specific type argument, because it is just broader about the ways in which Apple advantages itself. Like, there's always that stupid, and it's not dumb. It's overly simplistic, but it's not dumb, which is that the order, the hierarchy of needs or the hierarchy of importance to Apple is Apple at the top, users, and the developers. But Apple always wins. If users happen to benefit and they still get to make high margin products, great. And then anybody else, who cares? But it's always Apple at the top. And like, I think they're getting to a point in size where that's not something that can go unchecked. So I'm excited for this.
The other kind of, I guess, just like high level thing I've been thinking about, which, you know, others have brought up as well, which is so much of this is an own goal on Apple's part, where,
oh, totally,
a lot of the practices that certainly could be considered monopolistic, if they were to change to make things like more of an even playing field, for lack of a better phrase, Apple would still do really, really, really well, because, you know, they make a lot of really great stuff. They make a lot of great hardware, a lot of great software, a lot of good services. So a lot of the aggressive behavior that they've engaged with over the last decade plus has just not even really been necessary.
Thank you. No, that's the thing. And that's the thing that while I was reading this, I kept going back to. It's just that if Apple had been less crappy about supporting RCS and they dropped the App Store commissions to like 7% and 10%, none of this would happen.
Yeah.
Like, right. Like this would be such, like, I don't know how nobody inside the company is just like, yeah, this, like, yes, we're making less money here, but this avoids so many problems. Like, if you were less shitty in a couple of key areas, nobody would care. Like, it boggles the mind. Like, especially, like, because that is that, and that's the frustrating part with why, like, where, again, you're saying that it does not really address the App Store in a meaningful way, because there are so many things. Like, I think that's the one interesting part about the DMA, which is that, like, the whole, like, anti-steering stuff where this doesn't even, like, I think one of the most egregious ways that Apple disadvantages consumers is that you will not get an app update approved if Netflix says, hey, you can sign up at Netflix.com. That is illegal in Apple land. That is some of the stuff that is just so egregious and ridiculous that is not mentioned here at all. But I mean, they're fighting a larger, different battle, but that's the part that is just bananas, that they don't need to be doing this. And it's that, I don't think hubris is the right word. I'm sure you'll come up with a better one, but like, it's just, yeah, it's just that stubbornness and entitlement is just so fucking ridiculous.
Well, and I think the word that immediately comes to mind is insecurity, which, you know, again, this is not a original point by any means, but this idea that, you know, because Apple was so close to essentially disappearing at one point in its history, that memory has, you know, forever been burned into their minds, and they in a lot of ways continue to operate as if, you know, they could go bankrupt tomorrow, when in reality their circumstances could not be, you know, any more different today.
I feel like that's something, like, I feel like that's an excuse that some people who will say, like, oh, I'm a bad friend, or I'm toxic. Like, I feel like that's something that they don't get to keep saying. That extinction level event was 25 years ago. And when you have a $2.6 trillion market cap, you don't get to keep pretending like this dollar is your last dollar that you're ever going to get. And the way that you win is by shaking down Marco Arment.
I think that's what makes it so egregious and so what an indictment on Apple's culture, where it was so long ago and under such different circumstances, and the fact that it's still ingrained within the company, I think is a huge failure on Apple's part. Like, the fact that that mentality hasn't been stamped out of the company is a huge mistake.
Yeah. And going back to, and like just a 20-second sidebar, and again, it's not relevant to this specific topic, but the thing about, like, again, in the DMA news, where Phil Schiller, who, what is his title with the company? Like, I thought he sort of doesn't really work for them anymore. He sends,
ambassador or something. I forget what his title was.
He's emailing Tim Sweeney being like, oh, I don't think you guys are going to be faithful to the rules, so I'm going to, like, it's stuff like this that's just so petty and pretending like you're I can't think of a basketball analogy, but something where you're the little guy and you're actually the big guy. I don't know. You fill that in for me. So yeah, it's interesting and exciting. And if anybody needs, I think it'll take you an hour and a half to read it at most, or I'm talking to the listener. Or if you need something to read your kids to go to bed, that's fine. It's like there's so much stuff in here that's wrong that's really funny. Like, where is the quote, many prominent well-financed companies have tried and failed to successfully enter the relevant markets because of these entry barriers. Past failures include Amazon, which released its Fire mobile phone in 2014 but could not profitably sustain its business and exited the following year. I'm sorry, the iPhone is why the Fire Phone was a piece of shit. That's there's so much stuff here that's just that anybody who knows anything about technology, like, I don't know how they didn't have somebody read this and means like, no, actually, that's not really helping your argument. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff here. The only, again, we talked about, the only part that really does not stress me out, but like kind of, I think, is technically true, but spiritually, if actually inaccurate, is that Apple Wallet and the digital payments system is actually way better. Did you listen to the Six Colors podcast?
I'm only about maybe 15 minutes into it.
Did you get to the part where they talked about like all the contactless stuff?
I don't think so. No.
But anyway, like this isn't a spoiler. Jason makes the point that the reason contactless payments made headway in the United States is because of Apple. That's not true. It was the chip transition that required everybody in the U.S. to change their payment terminals out to be able to insert your card. And most of those happen to also have NFC readers. So no, the Apple was not the reason that happened, but that was a weird one-off point that was frustrating. But anyway, you got anything else on it? I assume more thoughts will marinate over the coming weeks. Cause this is also, this is going to be slow moving.
Yeah.
Do you have anything or no?
No.
Oh, sorry. The one other thing is like there was what was the throwaway thing about CarPlay?
Oh, there was Neli had a post about this. Like I guess it's a little not ambiguous, but maybe isn't super clear in the complaint. But what the DOJ? Well, you read it.
Section 125 says Apple quote Apple's threatened dominance over the automotive industry goes well beyond the Apple Wallet and Apple's demand on car makers to allow innovative products and services on the iPhone. Apple's smartphone dominance extends to CarPlay, an Apple infotainment system that enables car central display to serve as a display for the iPhone, enables blah, 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 blah. Quote, after leveraging its smartphone dominance to car infotainment systems, Apple has told manufacturers that the next generation of Apple CarPlay will take over all the screen sensors and gauges in a car, forcing users to experience driving as an iPhone-centric experience if they want to use any features provided by CarPlay. Here, too, Apple leverages its iPhone user base to exert more pressure over its trading partners, including American car makers, in future innovation. So that can be read two ways. And yeah, I saw this on Threads. Neli has a good point. Where people think, like people's initial hot takes on this was that, like the lawyers don't know what the fuck they're talking about. And they're thinking that the newer version of CarPlay is like an all or nothing, take it or leave it thing. But Neli does bring up the point, which is that if you read it more like a little bit more lawyerly or whatever, it is possibly that there's a heavy-handed negotiation technique where if you want any future enhancements of CarPlay or want to license it or whatever, that you do have to cede way more of the dashboard or more stuff to Apple to have access to any of it. And there's nobody knows what if that's actually the case, but that's interesting. And that is, even if that's not the case, the fact that it actually could be is kind of interesting.
Well, I assume the more is going to leak out around that, because I mean the DOJ got it from somewhere, so somebody will leak something at some point. We'll learn more about that.
Yeah, because I think is like, well, the part that I'd like to put a finer point on it is that in the early days of CarPlay, Apple just wanted it everywhere to the point where, like, I assume they would have done anything to get people to adopt it. Whereas now it's a thing where because iPhone is, and that was the other part of this article or of the complaint that was interesting, is they tried to like to fluff up the numbers about Apple's market share in the U.S. They broke out something called performance smartphones, which is not a term that exists, but they just wanted to find a thing where they could say Apple has 70% of the market. But now that, so iPhones tend to be owned by people of higher-ish incomes compared to Android phones relative to the cost of the phone itself. And those are generally people who are buying more cars. And therefore, those are people who want CarPlay in their automobiles. And if that now becomes an in-demand feature as opposed to something that Apple just really wants everybody to adopt, they could be more withholding. Sorry, I know I'm thinking of Lucille Bluth. They could be more withholding or put more onerous terms on what enabling CarPlay means, and whether that means there's more telematics going to Apple or there's just more deeper integration. I have no idea. But that, yeah, that's interesting. Real interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Got anything else? Or just do some chef's specials?
Chef's specials. Let's do it. I think I briefly previewed this one with you when we saw each other offline last week. I guess most of my TV and movie recommendations these days are going to be kind of months, if not years, behind, just because that's where I'm at with most media these days. But I finally got around to watching season 2 of The White Lotus, and it's so good. That show is it's great. I watched season 1 in the fall last year, and then yeah, just got around to watching season 2. It's great. That's such a good show. So if you're somebody else out there who has not seen it yet, go do so. It's great.
I mentioned those last, or when we talked about it in person. Talk about a show I cannot imagine you watching and or enjoying. Interesting. Yeah. it features, this is not a spoiler, April Ludgate in a more dramatic role.
Yeah, she's really good.
Always good. There's also, and I gotta forget if I told you this in person, there's a movie that's not a great movie, but it's a quick, breezy Netflix watch. It's called, I think, called Emily the Criminal. And it's if Aubrey Plaza chose a life of crime, worth a watch in the background. But yeah, okay, this is not a spoiler. Do you like, what's her name? What's her name?
Tanya?
Yes. Do you like her?
No.
Do you wish whenever she's on screen, she would not be on screen?
Oh, I mean, I enjoyed watching the character, but I didn't.
Wait.
Well, I mean, I guess what version of like are you? Like, I mean,
I'm not saying would you want to like her to be like your roommate or something, like, but like, did you when she was on screen, did you want hope? Like I found her character very, 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 very grating and unpleasant and not enjoyable to watch. I mean, which is probably successful.
Okay.
But,
I mean, I think that's kind of part of the deal.
Yeah. Like other than the gays are trying to kill me, I'm not sure she had any funny lines or anything.
I thought her story was, yeah, it was really well done. And yeah, no spoilers, but I mean, her, you know, the way that story concludes in the season was something.
Mm-hmm. I normally have a recommendation. I don't this week, so that's fine. No, actually, no, this is not just special, but I watched the movie Past Lives. I've been meaning to watch a couple of the Oscar bait movies the Oscars have passed. But the Oscar Best Picture nominees. I watched the movie Past Lives. It was fine. But I think it's on Max, or it's on something, so where you can stream it. So yeah, go watch that.
Not even I've not even heard of that one. Which again shows how far behind I am with a lot of pop culture.
I like movies where nothing happens.